Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
There was a movie that came out it's probably decades ago now. I start to look at when movies came out and realize how long ago they came out. But there was a movie, maybe when it was in about high school, that was called Taken. And basically this premise of this movie was this daughter travels overseas with a friend, gets to an airport, hops in the car with her friend into this nice young man's car, but he abducts her, takes her. But her dad is Liam Neeson, and he has one of those famous voices, and one of the famous lines in this movie is when he calls up the kidnappers, the people that have abducted them, and he answers the phone, and he says, "If you're looking for ransom, I can tell you I don't have any money. But what I have is a particular set of skills. Skills I have acquired over a very long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you. If you let my daughter go now, that will be the end of it. I will not look for you. I will not pursue you. But if you don't, I will look for you. I will find you, and I will kill you." Now, this premise of the movie is about this man with a particular set of skills chasing down his daughter to be able to find this. And we turn now to chapter 30, where the change of events in chapter 29, all building up to this battle. Chapter 28, Saul goes to the medium at Endor, this woman who tells her, "Tomorrow you will die." And all of it's building up to this moment, but then there's this detour. The battle for David is canceled. He heads home to Ziklag, and that's a large journey. It's about a 60-mile journey, and just imagine you're up there at Shechem, or up near the north, about to go in at Aphek, to go into battle, and you're told to turn around and go home. And you're to walk home, and you're to walk home with 600 men, traveling on this journey to be able to go make it there in your full armor. You know, you're not traveling light. You're not doing this 60 miles just with a pack of water on your back. You're doing it with your armor. You're doing it with all, whole camp of men. And this long and arduous journey happens. But as this journey happens, we've realized that this is really a dark hole in David's journey. You might call these godless chapters. And what I mean by godless chapters is not that God is not present, God is not working, as we looked at last week in this change of events, that God used the Lord, Yahweh, used these five small lords to be able to send David away back home. And we see today maybe a little bit of God's providence in why he did that. But here, these godless chapters where David is not seeking to pursue God on an external factor. It looks like he's walking away. He's not in the promised land. He's living with the Philistines. And again, it's not that God is not present, but it seems that David doesn't seem to be seeking God. He doesn't seem to be a man after God's own heart. Whereas this, you know, and this is basically just me trying to read the black ink on the page. Obviously, we don't know for sure. Just what's not said doesn't mean that it wasn't said. But what it seems like, there's no mention of God. There's no mention of the Lord. There's a mention of Lord in chapter 28 when Samuel comes up and Saul says, as the Lord lives, he makes this promise. And same with Achish. Achish makes that same promise. As the Lord lives, he uses Yahweh's name, but it doesn't come from David's lips. This kind of absence. But here we see that he's on his way back, and we look at the first six verses that are taken captive. "Now, when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, the Amalekites had made a raid against Negev and against Ziklag. They had overcome Ziklag and burned it with fire. and taking captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great. They killed no one, but carried them off and went their way. And when David and his men came to the city, they found it burned with fire, and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. Then David and the people who were with them raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength to weep. David's two sons had also been taken captive, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters. And here, there's some key things that Gad, I think the author at this point, is trying to point out to us, that they come back and there's this burnt village. It repeats that several times, that they burned it with fire, that they burned it with fire. Several times that he repeats that their village, their home, where David had made his home for the last 16 months, is now burned with fire. As they were walking home after this long, arduous 60-mile journey, they start to see smoke billowing on the horizon. You know, just imagine driving home tonight and you drive and you see smoke kind of around where your house is. And the closer you get to it, the more you realize that it's your house that has been burned down. But not only is the village now burnt and burnt to the ground, but the women are taken. And Gad points out that the women are taken captive. And these military men, just imagine that same scenario of not just you going home tonight, but a soldier coming back from years or even just days on the battlefield, willing to risk their life and come back and realize that their home is gone. But not only their home is gone, their family is gone, their wives, their sons, their daughters. The main reason people go to war is to protect your wife, your children, their future, their freedoms. And that's been taken away in this moment when they're off trying to fight for these freedoms, fight for their family, they're gone. And it's hard to imagine going home after being rejected, marching for 3 days to find your home and family absolutely destroyed. And we find an emotional summary of what happens in verse 4. Then David and all the people who were with them raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength to weep. These are grown men who, if they had their way, they would still be up in effect, maybe making their way to Israel to go into war, to fight battles. And yet, they're drained. What an emotionally draining voice. That they lift their voices and wept. Not only did they weep, but they wept to the point where they had no more tears. They had no more strength to weep. Weeping doesn't take much energy. Weeping doesn't take many calories. But yet, here they have no more strength to be able to weep. The Amalekites didn't come to take their children and their wives to a better place, to Disneyland. They took them to be slaves, to be their concubines. And sorry to be blunt, most likely raped them. This horrendous crime and this horrendous act is right before their eyes. And again, you just think of the reason many of them probably left. Said goodbye to their wives and families. I'll be home soon. You know, I'm going to go make sure we live in a safe place. Not only their distress, but David is greatly distressed in verse 6. There's just two quick comments of this, quite an understatement. Not only the wives of your soldiers and children, the families are destroyed of people that you sought to look after, to shepherd, but also your own family is gone as a king. He fought so hard to try and keep everything, and yet now everything has been taken from him. There's two comments on this that David was greatly distressed. Saul was in the same situation. In verse 28, Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me from bringing me up?" And Saul answered, "I am in great distress, for the Philistines are warring against me, and God has turned away from me, and he answers me no more, either by prophets or by dreams. Therefore, I have summoned you to tell me what I shall do." And again, this contrast comes up just a couple of chapters early. Saul goes through the same emotions of being greatly distressed. The Philistines have come to take them. He has no answers, and he's greatly distressed. And now we find King David in that same situation, that he too is greatly distressed. Not only he is greatly distressed of the situation which is around him, but his men seek to be able to stone him. That his men wanted to stone him. They came to him. Ultimately, as you remember, all these group of misfits and men, these men that have surrounded David right from the start this time, about 600 men, it hasn't really grown a lot during this time. But in verse chapter 22, verse 2, "And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him, and he became commander over them. And there were about 400 men." Now, after following him, after giving their lives, after risking their lives, they have nothing. And they hold David responsible. And I think, without again reading too much into it, without trying to read the white in between the black words, I think we can see that this is David's folly coming to an end. David's outcome of his folly, of his decision to leave the promised land, of his decision to come to Achish. I don't want to read too much into that, but I do think that's the outcome of what it is, that he was leading these men, and he was leading these men poorly. But then we come to a great shift in this godless chapters, this great shift found at the end of verse 6, which says, "But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God." But David, here he is in this low time of his life, great depression, great walking away, wandering it seems. Everyone has turned on him. Saul was against him, and he had these 600 men to be able to support him. But now these 600 men have turned on him, seeking to be able to stone him, holding him responsible, and responsible according to law of God. But David, a great shift in the passage, where I think in this past 16 months he has possibly been walking away from God. But yet, now God comes on his lips again. Yahweh becomes a word which flows from his mouth. And it was through this great low that brings him back to God. Saul was greatly distressed, and he went to a medium to be able to connect him to Samuel. David is greatly distressed, yet he turns his back to God for his strength. And Saul goes to Samuel and he's in great distress. And what happens at the end after he speaks to Samuel? He finds himself, and there was no strength in him. Verse 20 of chapter 28 says, "For he had eaten nothing all day and night." Again, remember back to Hannah's prayer right at the start in chapter 2. "And the bows of mighty are broken, and the feeble bind on strength." David at this low point turns back to God and strengthens himself. I've seen this again before, bringing this up in chapter 23. "And Jonathan, Saul's son, rose and went to David at Horesh, and strengthened his hand in God." And David, Jonathan utters these words to David, and he says, "Do not fear, for the hand of Saul, my father, shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Saul, my father, knows this." Maybe as he strengthened himself in the Lord, he remembers how Jonathan strengthened David in the Lord. "You shall be king over Israel." David, at this point, I think this prodigal has returned. When his men are standing there and are against him, he turns to God for strength. What a great contrast it is from Saul and David. In these last chapters that are so intertwined, they show all these connections. That Saul is greatly distressed, turns to a medium, and then has no strength left. David is greatly distressed. He turns to the Lord and then, therefore, has strength. Now maybe this is what the point found in chapter 22, 2 Samuel chapter 22. David utters a prayer towards the end of his kingship. And this prayer also found in Psalm 18. And he says, "In my distress I called upon the Lord, and to my God I called. From his temple he heard my voice, and my cry came to his ears." But not only here it says that my God I called. But we see that in this passage as well. That it says that he strengthened himself in the Lord, but it doesn't stop there. It says his God. The Lord his God. This beautiful statement. Although David might have turned his back on God, God never turned his back on David. Like the prodigal father waiting for his son, lost son, to be able to come home. Now I joke with Sarah sometimes, and when a child is quite emotional, we might look at one another and say, "Well, he is your son, or she is your daughter. At this moment, you can deal with them." And maybe late at night when we're half tired. Yet God does not pass David off. And David finally can say that God is his God. That God is always our God. Psalm 50 explains, "Hear my voice, O my people, and I will speak. O Israel, I will testify against you. I am God, your God." And I've mentioned this before, but the importance of possessive pronouns in the Bible. That it's not just enough to be able to acknowledge God as God, but acknowledge God as your God, as your Savior. As Thomas says, "My Lord," after he sees him. And this is what he says. That he strengthened himself not just with a God, but the God who is his God. One commentator explained it as, one thing to know Christ as the great shepherd, but it's another thing to know Christ as my great shepherd. They're completely different. And here, David strengthens himself. The godless chapters cease. Again, that contrast is not that David is perfect and Saul is a sinner. They're both sinners. And they both go through their differences and their weaknesses. But it's that a true believer will turn and turn back to God. And we get no more information about what happened in this situation. Here you have 600 men wanting to stone you. How did this discussion go? Did David say, "Look over there and just run away"? We have no idea. But it just says that he strengthened himself in the Lord's. Now, just a couple of comments. Even after this amazing twist, this amazing turn at the end of chapter 6, that we might strengthen ourselves in the Lord. But we need to note that the problem then doesn't disappear. It's not this magic light switch that everything just is turned back. They're still confronted. David doesn't strengthen himself in the Lord and the wives and children come marching over the hill. Doesn't then undo all the emotions, the sorrow, the weeping that is happening. But I think even at this point, he's reminded of God's provision, providence throughout all of his past. Here, I think you see a change. Last week, you see a change of direction given by the small L lords. You're not going into battle. You're going back home. But I think here you see a change in heart, that David turns his heart. One of the number one things that we notice when our children start to be sick, it's not necessarily a fever, it's not necessarily, you know, there's things exiting their nose that shouldn't. They're signs. But the number one thing that we really know our child is sick is we can turn to that each other and say, you know, Stella's just not herself. You know, Stella's not really talking a lot. Calvin's really not running around a lot. But then after they get better, then we say they're back to their old self. And this is what happens, I think, here in David. David, we see this change where he's back. He's a man again after God's own heart. His heart took his slight detour. Doesn't then mean he's reprobate. It means that he's a believer that struggles with sin. And he turns back to God and he strengthens himself in God, his Lord. But then he also goes and turns to the Lord for advice, something that has been absent throughout this whole time. In verses 7 and 8, and David said to Abiathar, to the priest, the son of Ahimelech, bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David, and David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue after this band? Shall I overtake them? And he answered them, pursue, for you shall surely overtake, and you shall surely rescue. Now again, this contrast of Saul in chapter 28, and Saul inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams, Urim, or prophets. Saul inquires of the Lord, but gets nothing. David, as strengthened by the Lord, now the Lord answers him. And the Lord responds from Abiathar, saying, overtake, overtake. This is what it, in this translation that I had before, it said that you shall surely overtake and you shall surely rescue. In Hebrew, it's just the same word twice. Overtake, overtake, rescue, rescue. And even that word rescue is undertones of the word deliver. That you will deliver them. You will be their deliverer. Then we come to the division in verses 9-10. So here they are. They're back in Ziklag after this 60-mile trek down south. And they're going to start to pursue. And he's with his 600 men. And they start going down to where the Amalekites are from in Amalek. And they start heading down. And David sets out, and there's 600 men who were with him. And they came to the brook Besor, where those who were left behind stayed. But David pursued, and he had 400 men, 200 stayed behind, who were too exhausted to cross over the brook of Besor. So you just imagine traveling 60 miles over the course of 3 days, 20 miles a day, and not just, you know, carrying a light backpack, but your full armor gear. You get back home, you're emotionally drained to the point where you cannot weep any longer. And then you pick up your bags again, not just again, just a light pack to be able to travel, but enough to be able to fight. You're chasing down people who were, came and raided, two places at least, Negev and Ziklag. And there's possibly about 15 miles now, to the Brook of Besor. Now, when we moved here, we, started, checking out sites, and one day we went down to the, Creeper Trail. And there's all this commotion and all these, you know, people running, and we start asking who they are and where they're from, and they're from all over America, and they come to run the Creeper Trail, a thing called the Yeti, which is an ultra trail run. It's 100 miles. So you start at White Top, you run down to Abingdon, you run back up, and you run back down to Abingdon. Basically, yeah, 100 miles. It's funny, we're staying in the hotel, and the next day we saw a man, and we caught the elevator with this man, and he was limping. And he was explaining what the Yeti is, that he comes, you know, he's up from Pennsylvania or something, and he explained that, you know, there's limited spaces because you can only have certain people, but the people sign up for this, and it's sold out within like hours. It goes live at like midnight, and anyway, and he was crippled, and he said, "Oh, I love it." He's like limply hobbling along, groaning, you know. But anyway, and this is what has happened over these men, and they get to the Brook of Besor, and there's about 200 men that just cannot go any further, and so they try and do something like that, you know, from White Top to Abingdon, and then back up to White Top. Different elevation, but you got about 33 miles between there and there. So you're doing that for 3 days, carrying full body armor, to fight wars. You imagine, you know, these 200 people saying, "I am exhausted. I can't go any more." And this is going to be important for next week, but this is what happens here, that they're exhausted, and, I understand completely. I don't even know if I could walk from White Top to Abingdon. But here now we turn to verse 11 to 15. And we'll look at this in a couple of weeks. These strange providences that happen all throughout the book of 1 Samuel. But we then meet the Egyptian in verses 11 to 15. And in start of verse 11, it explains, "And they found an Egyptian." You would not believe. Have you ever heard one of those stories? Just, you would not believe who I saw when I walked into the store. Or you would not believe. You know, I was just looking for this certain thing and someone came, and you would not believe what happened here. And this is one of these stories. And they were going along, they were trying to pursue the Amalekites. And you would not believe that they met this Egyptian. And in verses 11 to 12, it explains, "They found an Egyptian in the open country and brought him to David. And they gave him bread, and he ate, and he gave him water to drink, and they gave him a piece of cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights." And before they even know anything about this man, they find him in distress, and they stop and help. You maybe get these undertones of a Good Samaritan story. They give him some food, some water, and then finally they get an answer. David asks the question in verse 13, and David said to him, "To whom do you belong, and where are you from?" And he said, "I'm a young man of Egypt, a servant of an Amalekite, and my master left me behind because I fell sick 3 days ago." So 3 days ago, they're going along this journey, and the Amalekites left him for dead because he was sick. So David, again, he takes him in. He feeds him. But you don't want to necessarily dwell on these things too much, but it's an interesting thought. This man most likely burned someone's house down, captured someone's wife and children 3 days ago, and now they're giving them something to eat and something to drink. Just a thought to ponder. But then in verse 14, they explain that we had made a raid against Negev and the Cherethites, and against which belongs to Judah, and against the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. And this nameless Egyptian goes forward and explains what he has done. Right before David has inquired of the Lord, was the answer to David's question. Before he said, will we find them? Will we overtake them? And the Lord said, yes, he will find them. But this is before. This Egyptian was left here before even David inquired of the Lord. This happened days before. The Lord was answering his question even before David had asked it. So, David then, through the providence of God, find this Egyptian, and David asked him to lead these 400 men with him on this military expedition. So David now hands his whole military expedition into the hands of a stranger, places it and says, lead us to where they are. So David asks him a question. Will you take down to this band? And he said, swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this band. The Egyptian wants a deal. He wants an agreement. If I'm going to do this, if I'm going to risk my life, you need to promise that you're not going to hand me back over, that my life is not worth it for me. I will only do it if you do not kill me and don't give me back to my master. Now, swear to me that by God that you will, what you will do. Sometimes it means different things. But here it says, don't kill me, don't deliver me into the hands of my master. Now this actually is a law in Deuteronomy chapter 23. It says that you shall not give up to his master a slave who has escaped from his master to you. He shall dwell with you in your midst in the place that he shall choose within one of your towns. Whether it suits him, you shall not wrong him. So here, David is basically told, will you uphold the law? You might be able to get a lawyer to go in and look that he did not escape his master, so this law is conditional. You don't want to go into that. But that here, David is asked, don't give me back to my master. But then he makes this agreement and says that he will take this band of brothers, this 400 men, down to where the Amalekites are. Now, this is where we're going to stop tonight, and obviously, we're going to have to tune in next week to see what happens. The heading in my Bible just automatically gives it away. It says, David defeats the Amalekites. So if you're that anxious to know what happens, but what an interesting turn of events last week that David was walking into battle against the Philistines, with the Philistines against Israel. And then now we have David's heart change, his change of heart back where he is again, I think where his heart is seeking after God. And God has blessed him and placed now this, through his providence, this Egyptian to be able to lead them to this situation.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.